Welcome to Countersign. In these podcasts, I discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. This is the second series of Countersign. You can catch up on series one wherever you get your podcasts or by visiting countersignisapodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We welcome your feedback. More details at countersignisapodcast.com. Mark Nishanian's book, The Historiographic Perversion, concerns the extermination of Armenians during the Ottoman Empire in 1915 and the years that followed. This is a deeply philosophical book that, at its core, asks the question of what a genocide as an event will be grounded on in terms of its facticity and truth. The opening provocation of the book is contained in the following words, and I quote, "Genocide is not a fact. Genocide is not a fact because it is the very destruction of the fact, of the notion of fact, of the factuality of fact." In what sense can a genocide fail to be a fact? First, in its crudest terms, a genocide is subject to denial and negation, and it is precisely this that took place in France in the 1990s when prominent historians were willing to acknowledge and admit that there were massacres and mass killings of the Armenians during the Ottoman Empire, but not an event worthy of the appellation genocide. This denial is common to other contexts as well. I'm thinking, for instance, of the Stolen Generation in Australia, the systematic removal of Aboriginal children from their parents, and the refusal of Australia as a state to acknowledge that this was a genocide. Of course, any comparison of one genocide to another takes us to the heart of the problem and the fact that, in Lyotard's words, with Auschwitz, something new happened in history, something that is a sign and not a fact. With Auschwitz as the emblematic sign of a genocide, what will other genocides be grounded on? Will it be a truth established by historians or by law, or the memory of survivors? Or indeed, is it the case that each of these categories present the problem of representation, the impossibility of representing the event of a genocide? One of the extraordinary insights that Mark Nishanian brings to this problem is that the impossibility of representation, which I have just described, is linked very closely to what Nishanian terms the destitution of the fact. That is to say, the fact that the fact itself is destroyed by the genocidal will. Understanding the nature of the genocidal will is absolutely crucial. So it is not enough to understand genocide as a crime constituted by a particular intention and so on and so forth. But one has to understand that the genocidal will involves destroying the fact of the destruction. The role of the archive and historians is crucial here, because as Nishanian explains it, genocide is enabled by the gathering of an archive, the amassing of supposedly objective material and data that is able to legitimize particular kinds of actions, murders and exterminations as being part of a process of war, of transportation, of famine. So without the archive, there is no genocide. What is then to be done with the crisis of representation in relation to genocide? Is the answer to be found in literature or in art? Nishanian takes us to a profound insight, that which is grounded in the shame of having to testify again and again, to prove, to bring proof again and again, that historians keep demanding proof. And so the utter refusal to testify again and again, that, he says, is the condition of the absolute survivor. Mark Nishanian, welcome to Countersign. I'm honored that you have joined me to discuss your extremely provocative and influential book, The Historiographical Perversion. I have read this book many times in reading groups. It has traveled with me and it has informed my own work. So I'm delighted to be in conversation with you. And I thought it would be useful to begin by talking about the negation of the extermination of Armenians that has provoked your life's work, the extermination of Armenians in 1915 and the years that followed, and the later negation and denial of this event. It is in response to this that at the beginning of the book, you say, genocide is not a fact. Genocide is a destruction of the fact. So this has been an extremely provocative philosophical reflection on the history of the event of the extermination and the catastrophe. And you say that it has taken almost an entire life for you to write these words. So I would like you to begin by saying a little bit about that peripatetic scholarly life and your response to this problem of negationism.
I'll try. Thank you for the invitation, Stewart. I liked your word, peripatetic. I'm not sure. And I will tell you a few words. I was born in France, as maybe you know. I defended a PhD in philosophy. When was that? 1979, 1980. I was at that time already teaching in the university in Strasbourg. Mm-hmm. I was, a student with Jean-Luc Nancy. It's with him that I did my PhD, but also Philippe Lacoulabart and so on. At that time, it was very, how should I say, a rich intellectual life maybe in Strasbourg, thanks to Lacoulabart and Nancy. After 1980, I was 2 years in Jerusalem. I began to teach philosophy at the Armenian Seminary in Jerusalem. I also learned Hebrew. Then I was again in Strasbourg. I began to teach in the United States, first UCLA, then Columbia University in New York in 1995. And after 11 years in New York, and after 2007, I was a few years, one semester every year in Istanbul, Sabancı University, in a department called Cultural Studies, where my teaching was more philosophical. In New York, it was the Department of Middle East, and I was a professor of Armenian Studies, let's say, something like that. This is the peripatetic life.
Yes.
About the book, because we are going to speak about historiographic perversion. It was a book, first written in French. Probably I will tell you a bit about the circumstances.
Yes.
First written in French, translated into English by Gilani Jar. probably 2009, the year of publication in the
yes,
English version.
Right.
The book in French was written in at different moments, I would say, of my life, and it's not a book, you know, written in one shot, let's say.
Yes.
Because it took me time, Stewart, to understand what was happening. It took me time to understand the thing itself, the perversion. After so many years of state denial, hesitation on the facts, and qualification of the facts, and so on, the first chapter was written in 1994-95, immediately after the trial of Bernard Lewis, because he was called to a tribunal in 1995 for his declarations, denialist declarations, very clearly.
Yes.
Concerning the so-called Armenian genocide. Second chapter and the second moment was 1999, again in France, and again it was this time what was called the Weinstein affair. Weinstein was, specialist, a very good specialist of Ottoman studies, and he was candidating for a position at the prestigious Collège de France, and at that time, people discovered a denialist, clearly a denialist article that he had written in 1994 in defense of Bernard Lewis, and then there was a campaign and against for him with petitions. The whole French scholarly, let's say, corporation signed petitions defending or protecting him. No, the third one, of course, we'll come back to this, of course, is my... I need a long, brooding on the book published in 1991, how was it called? Probing the Limits of Representation, and around the Holocaust, and where Hayden White was invited to defend himself, in fact, and that was the third chapter. Okay, that's the historiographic perversion, and that's my peripatetic life.
Yes, no, that is an excellent sort of summary of some of the key events that have provoked this reflection. And it's indeed very useful to go back to that moment, also the fertile philosophical context around Philippe Le Coullebat and Jean-Luc Nancy. And also many discussions with Jean-François Lyotard, and the question of representation in relation to the Holocaust, which is part of the philosophical setting from which you take up the question of negationism. So there is this... set of comments and declarations by Lyotard about the emblematic nature of
the name Auschwitz. Yeah, exactly.
The name Auschwitz, precisely. Yeah. And so, the name Auschwitz is presented as a sign and not a fact. And this emblematic characterization, the emblematic representation, as distinct from the generic term genocide, and this distinction, if you like, is one that you bring to bear in thinking about the question of representing the event of an extermination of a people.
Okay. you know, this difference between the name Auschwitz as the name of an event or the name of a sign, it is difficult to explain. It's part of the philosophical and I would say Kantian vocabulary of Lyotard. First, let's say the following. Lyotard's book, in French, Le Différent, it was published in 1974, very early, in fact. It was 2 years before the publication of the book. There was a colloquium, The Ends of Man, organized precisely by my professors of philosophy, where he spoke for the first time on these questions of negationism, which means denialism. The French word is negationisme. For the first time, probably he explained the event as the destruction of the fact. That's his words, very clearly. It's his words. It's not only mine. It's extraordinary. And I will quote, it's before my eyes, Lyotard. In fact, Lyotard cited by Ginsburg. I will tell you that probably later. Just let me quote a few lines. It's from Lyotard. The facts, the testimonies which bore the traces of here and now, the documents which indicated the sense or senses of the facts, and the names, finally, the possibility of various kinds of phrases whose conjunction makes reality, all this has been destroyed as much as possible. Then he asks, is it up to the historian to take into account not only the damages but also the wrong, not only the reality but also the meta-reality, that is, the destruction of reality, not only the testimony but also what is left of the testimony when it is destroyed? Then it's this extraordinary expression by Lyotard, meta-reality. It's the same in French, la meta-reality. Meta-reality, that is the destruction of reality. And he also speaks, you know, of an earthquake that destroyed precisely the archive. Maybe we'll come back to this word, the archive. Yes. He was the first one, Lyotard, to begin to reflect on this question. That's number one. Number two, the other author who made a lot in order to, to understand and to explain to us that there is something else to say about testimony than using testimony for documenting the facts. That's, as you know, Giorgio Agamben in his book, which is also for me an extraordinary book, published in 1999, then 25.
This is Remnants of Auschwitz.
Remnants of Auschwitz, exactly.
Yes.
Okay. Then that's my references, probably, and my third important reference, as you know, he's the hero of my book. That's Hayden White, and we'll say a few words probably about him a bit later. But tell me first. Let me first say that you used in your question, that a few minutes ago, the word representation. I don't remember exactly your formulation, but Stewart, there is a distinction to be made between, and this distinction is essential probably, between the what I call the destitution of the fact. The fact that the fact is destroyed by the genocidal will, and then distinction with that, and the impossibility of representation. And why should we do a distinction? Just in order to understand the essential link between the one and the other. It's through the impossibility of representation that in some way we can understand what the catastrophe is, which also means what the genocidal will is. But these are two different things. The at first glance, the fact that what we call genocide or the catastrophe, the effect of this genocidal will to what it will is to destroy the fact as such, not the facts in the plural, the fact as such. It's a philosophical endeavor to destroy the fact such. And the executioners, the perpetrators, they were philosophers, Stewart. They knew better than everyone what it meant to destroy the fact as such. And on the other side, the interdiction, the forbidding of representation, which is related to it, which is another aspect of the same question, but they have to be distinguished in order to understand the relation between the one and the other. Am I understandable, Stewart?
yes, absolutely. And this is precisely, you're putting the finger on the nature of the historiographical perversion, because the historiographical perversion is the repetition of this combination of the destitution of the fact and the impossibility of representation. So in a sense, you're also asking the question, why do you have to do it again? Because precisely the extermination, the destruction is the elimination of the fact, the elimination of those who may bear witness to their own condition and their own existence. This is the destruction. But you repeat the destruction through denial.
That's interesting. First, you know that because you also asked something about the history, maybe, of the extermination and the history of denial, in fact. Huh? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. The extermination itself, it was in 1915, 1916, Ottoman Empire, not Turkey yet, huh? Ottoman Empire. And
yes,
so
Ottoman,
on.
Yes.
And it's not the place, maybe, to say anything more about that, but, you know, it coincided with the transformation of the empire into a nation state. Huh?
Yes.
And of course, I'm not sure that that is the topic of our discussion, but of course we have also to understand what it means, this transformation, what it involves in terms of unifying a country, destroying the differences, and anything like that.
So it's a question of the origin of what is modern 20th century Turkey. It's an originary moment.
Of course, but it's also, you understand, a revealing moment for what we call a nation state, because you can be sure that in the DNA of all nation states, there is a genocidal will, of course, but not apparent. It became apparent in the case of the Ottoman Empire, because there was a transformation, a passage, and this transformation needed the elimination of all differences, let's say, and in the DNA of all nation states, you can be sure there is the genocidal will. That's the topic of another discussion. Mm-hmm. But let me say now, there was and there has been a constant politics and policy of state denial on the part of Turkey as a nation state, precisely after 1922. That's the first step, should I say, the first step of denial, the one that we understand very well. The perpetrator denies his own actions and so on. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's there is a relay in scholarly, again, corporation among some historians. At that time, it was not generalized, mainly specialists of the Ottoman Empire, who were relaying the state denial within their own sphere, then that's the first step, the first level of denial. It didn't happen, it was not a genocide, and so on. And you don't forget, Stewart, that the word genocide was invented after the second, or within, during the Second World War by Lemkin. And Lemkin, among others, of course, referred to, because he was aware of the Armenian, what is to be called now the Armenian genocide, of course, but we call it the Armenian genocide because Lemkin was referring to it when he invented the word in 1942 or 46, and so on and so on. Okay, the next step of denial is much more subtle than this one, and that's why we needed such a long time in order to understand what was happening. It's not the denial of the facts anymore. It's something much more subtle than that. It's and it became obvious when, maybe in France, precisely with the trial against Bernard Lewis, the historians, as a corporation this time, they wanted to have the last word about qualification of the event, which also means, and this is maybe this passage different, is difficult to understand, which also means the reality of the event. And we needed to understand that the debate around the qualification of the event implied, in fact, a hidden debate about the reality of the event as genocide. That was difficult to understand, Stuart, very difficult to understand. What were they defending, these historians? Why they were they hesitating? Why they were debating around the qualification and the reality? What was their interest as historians, precisely? And it seems that they were defending history against every other external instance, I should say, that could decide instead of history or the historians themselves.
And I mean, that's a an important point. If I might just interject,
of course.
So because precisely there's a question of motivation here. Why? What is motivating the historian? And that is a very difficult question. But on the surface, at least in the context of the dispute, that on the surface it becomes a question of whether it is historiography or law that decides on the fact of an event.
You know, I prepared because I prepared myself for this discussion with you. I prepared a quote that I put at the beginning of my file full of quotes. And I even, it's a quote in French, and I even asked my friend Gil Anijar to translate that for me into English.
Thank you.
We are in 2012.
Yes.
And yes, we are in 2012. Then it needs an introduction. The book, The Historiographic Perversion, was published in French in 2005. The debates in France around the official recognition of the Armenian Genocide, by the way, almost always the so-called Armenian genocide. Debate in France took place between 1995 and 2012, in with different moments, all of them unpleasant moments, of course. It was there was first in 1998 a parliament decision, let's say, recognizing, but it was not official. It became official in 2001. In 2001, the French Parliament edicted a law with one phrase: the Armenian people were subject to a genocide in 1915 in the Ottoman Empire, something like that.
Yes.
That's 2001, huh? Then, after that, the Armenians, French Armenians, wanted, because that one phrase is useless, in fact. It's an official recognition. So what? Then they wanted one more step on the part of the French state. They wanted a law that, how should I say, prohibits or forbids any denialist, or penalizes or would penalize any denialist formulation. 2008, that was the first to move towards such a new law. And you know that such a law exists in France. It's new also, end of the, in the 90s, which is called La Loi Guesso, the Guesso law, which is a law that penalizes, I don't know if in English I should say penalizes the...
It prohibits, so it makes it unlawful.
Yes, unlawful, any, and also forces punishment for any any denialist account of the events during the Second World War. Okay? Probably the Armenians in France wanted a similar law for the Armenian genocide. And then in 2008, for the first time when it came before the parliament, there was an immense movement on the part of the historians in order to counter that possible law. And the creation of a committee of historians, an association called Liberté pour l'Histoire, Liberty for History. That was in 2008. The law didn't pass in 2008. It came again on the floor in 2012. And maybe you know, at that time in 2012, it was voted by the parliament, such a law, analogous to the Guesso law for the Second World War, and this time for the Armenians. And as again, maybe you know, the same school of historians, and not only historians, opposed the law, of course. It was voted nonetheless by the parliament, but it was invalidated by the, in French it's called le Conseil Constitutionnel, Constitutional Council, which is a sort of Supreme Court, you know, in France. And it doesn't exist now as a law because it was invalidated in 2012. And now, after that introduction, I read you a few words by Plenel, who is an influential French journalist, and who explains to us why it should not become a law. And then I read.
Yes.
It is one thing to ask that, out of concern for reparation or for recognition, an official statement carry in our collective memory the crimes committed against the ancestors of a segment of the national community, thus for the enslavement of Africans, the genocide of the Jews, and the genocide of the Armenians. It is another thing to transform this legitimate request into official history, instituted by political representatives and protected by judges. First paragraph. Second paragraph. In the case of the Armenian genocide, this dreadful change of register in which the burden of memory turned into the dogma of history, wow, which words, huh? Is accompanied by a dangerous geopolitical displacement for which the righteous Armenian cause is the pretext, thus instrumentalized to serve a bad cause. For no one will have failed to notice that the enslavement of Africans and the genocide of the Jews concern our national history, whereas the massacre of the Armenians was perpetrated by Turkey, a foreign state. It's extraordinary.
Yes.
And last third paragraph, it is obvious that we, the French, are concerned with the Armenian genocide, but does such a statement of good or well-meaning humanity authorize us to give a lesson to other nations and other peoples with regard to their own history, to legislate in their stead, to sanction in their name? Stewart, yes. This is in a nutshell the arguments that you understand that there is, as Freud would say, the argument of the kettle. The first paragraph being that the events have to be adjudicated by history, not by the law. Second paragraph being that it was in Turkey, it was not in France, we are not concerned. And the third paragraph is that we are not going to sanction something that happened elsewhere, not in France, and so on, so on. It's extraordinary, this series of arguments. It's, in a nutshell, what has been repeated again and again in 2012 in order to invalidate the possibility of having a law against the denial of the genocide. A crime against humanity, Stewart. It's not a national crime. It concerns humanity, precisely.
Yes.
And that's
yes.
why this argument that, it was in Turkey, it was not in France, it doesn't, we do not need to adjudicate or to edict a law for that. That was a shameful argument, Stewart. Shameful. But it was repeated by the best historians, by the best advocates of... and the main one was Robert Badinter, who, you know, is a well-known figure in France and so on. What I have read here repeated the arguments of Robert Badinter, in fact.
Yeah. I mean, it, in a sense, that passage that you've just read and the wonderful summary of the issue that you've just given takes us to the heart of this question of what is history for? You know, what is history if it is not about creating the space for the past to be understood and experienced in a particular way? And it seems to be that is what's at stake, a monopoly that the historians wish to have on the distribution of facts, if I can put it like that.
You know, Stewart, you were asking before I read this passage, you were asking, what is their interest? I say this once in the book, Stewart, I do not understand their interest.
Yes.
That's a mystery for me. Is it the defense of history? Is it the total incomprehension of what a crime against humanity is? Is it the will to repeat again and again that it's precisely it's not a crime against humanity? I do not understand. I do not know. I do not have the answer.
You know, I suppose partly because this denialism, this negation is repeated in many other contexts. Just recently, a few weeks ago, the Australian Prime Minister, on what Indigenous Australians call Invasion Day, but Australians want to refer to as Australia Day. It is the 26th of January, the day on which the British arrived to colonize and invade Australia in 1788. The Australian Prime Minister said to the nation, well, of course, these convicts who came, you know, it wasn't such a great time for them either, you know. So this was a sort of equivalence, drawing an equivalence between the beginning of a genocidal process of settling. Yes. And invading a territory, yes, with the experience of convicts being transported, the past that the historians and the politicians which wish to have control over, has a purchase in the present.
Yeah,
that is the that has to be part of what must be going on here. The way in which these past events, as you were saying in relation to the Turkish state, for example, that is the originary moment. And so there is a denial, actually, of the genocide that is at the originary moment of the Turkish state.
Of course.
And so it is this past reaching into the present and being so alive in the present.
First, let me connect with this, what we said, you said at the very end. In the case of what I call the genocidal will, in the case of what we call genocide in this 20th century, it's pretentious, but I would say we have to understand that. The crime is not only, if it was not enough, destroying lives, exterminating. It's destroying the fact that I am destroying. Then the denial, that's why you said originary, the denial is within the act itself. The real act, in fact, is, if it were a fact, I would say the real fact, but it's not. The real act is this destruction of what I am doing in the moment when I am doing it. The real act is this what I called at the beginning of the book, the destruction of the fact. That's why I'm saying that it's philosophical. Huh? And this is also why it has to be understood, not, of course, not historically, but philosophically. That's why it's constantly repeated. In fact, it's not the originary act. It's because it's the essence of the event, and it comes back again and again, in different forms, in the discourse of historians and the denialist discourse. Crimes against humanity. Yes, I understand. I am trying to connect the past and the present.
I think I wanted to connect this point to the problem of the archive. And indeed, what I think you're referring to here, the ongoing effacing of testimony that is so so central to sustaining the violence of the archive, if you like. That there is a... there is a violence in the archival process, in the process of archiving. And it is the historians that, of course, set themselves up as the custodians, the protectors, the administrators of the archive. And so this problem of the archive and of testimony is a manifestation of the genocidal will.
Then, before coming to this question of the archive, which is an important and difficult question, let me come back 1 second to the crime against humanity. It's something that I explain in the book. It's Anna Arendt, Eichmann in Jerusalem. She was distinguishing the expulsion, annihilation. These are her words. Annihilation of entire population as inhuman acts from the same acts as crimes against humanity. And the distinction is, what is the distinction? Is the following. Inhuman acts were those acts that would be explained by reasons belonging to the human realm, colonization, homogenization, and unification of a territory, and so on. And you understand that slavery, and also the example of Australia, is a part of this. Inhuman acts. Huh? And crimes against humanity, she says, I'm quoting, were those acts of which motive and aim are without precedent, which means, first of all, that no existing human logic could explain them. Then they are not motivated, the crimes against humanity. It's a paradox, of course, because if they are not motivated, they have no sense, and it's the absence of sense that that makes the motive, the absence of intent, of reason, of motive that makes sense of the event, at which makes the event what she calls crime against humanity. And what I am explaining in the book is that that's a very powerful logical matrix that is informing, in fact, all the reflection on denialism, testimony, and so on. This difference between crimes against humanity and inhuman acts, crimes against humanity being the crimes that have no reason, no motive, no sense, in fact. That was what I wanted to add. Now, let me come 1 second to the question of the archive. I'm repeating in the book several times that there are genocides only in the 20th century. Why? Because in order for a genocide to happen, which means, what is a genocide? It's a crime without truth. I have to explain that. A crime without truth. Which means a crime that cannot be, at first glance, cannot be explained by, let's say, historical reason. Then there are crimes only in the 20th century because these genocidal crimes are informed by what now we call archive. The genocidal perpetrators, they knew better than others what an archive was, and what they were doing was to destroy the possibility of the archive. And what is an archive? I will give you, let's say again, a philosophical definition. The archive is what contains the condition of possibility for a fact to become a fact. And you are, at the same time, destroying the possibility for becoming a fact of what you are doing. This is a very perverse and very efficient action. But at the same time, you see, there is what we call testimony. And the two have to be related, of course, the archive and testimony. Why? Because, and that's the new meaning of testimony. And that's this new meaning of testimony. It's something that happened before our own eyes in the last 30 years. The meaning of the word testimony changed radically, and that's why there has been a constant reflection on testimony on the part of the philosophers, beginning by Lyotard, of course, Agamben, Derrida himself, and so on, so on. And why? Because this time we have to think about of what it means when we say testimony, when it is about an event which is at its core, at the beginning, without truth, which means an event that aims at what? At destroying the witness. In what?
Yes.
In man, precisely. In man, in humanity. You understand? Destroying the witness in humanity. That's extraordinary. And beginning, when we understand that that's the aim of the perpetrator, then we have to think again from the beginning of what it means to testify, to bear witness, and so on. And you know the extraordinary formulation of Agamben, who needed to... and I think that it's the most important reflection on testimony that we have, this book, Remnants of Auschwitz. And it's a book where Agamben wants to liberate, to free testimony from its from what? From its archival meaning, I would say, from its meaning as document, let's say. And you know his formulation, then the witness is the one who is bearing witness about the impossibility of bearing witness, precisely.
Yes. Yeah. So then I think you also wanted to, I think it would be useful to touch on the on Hayden White, which you earlier said was
Hayden
the hero.
The hero. Yes. Hayden White is the hero. But no, not very long, Stewart. Hayden White, he was the one in the United States. He was an inspiring figure for me. He was the one in the United States who, from the beginning, tried to rethink history and to debate with historians about the meaning, the essence of history. And it was this article in 1982 where he had the most powerful formulations and at the same time the most ambiguous formulation about the historiography of genocides. Of course, he understood, he knew that there was something to be interrogated in the relation between the genocidal will and the genocidal event and historiography. And then he knew, of course, already that there was what later Derrida would call the crisis of historiography or the perversion of historiography. Because the historiographic perversion, don't forget, that's an expression that comes directly from Derrida.
Yes, in The Force of Law, his essay, The Force of Law.
And then 1982, Hayden White. He at the same time, you know, he gave the impression that it was a question of interpretation, the genocide or not, and so on. And then the interpretation and the reality of about the events is a question of dominant discourse, of power, and so on, so on. That's why he was invited 10 years later by the historians in UCLA at the same colloquium, in fact, where also Derrida had spoken for the first time his Force of Law. I read this somewhere. One day Derrida told me, but Marc, ce n'était pas un négationniste. Marc, he was not a negationist or a denialist about Hayden White. Of course not. Of course not. But that was all the more astonishing that when he tried to question the position and the role played by history, then he was deemed as a possible negationist by the historians, because when you question history, of course, then you question for them the reality of the event, then the reality of the Holocaust, then you can be maybe a negationist. That was an insulting, excuse me, I do not find the word, an insulting
condemnation
of Hayden White, of course. That's what I wanted to say about Hayden White.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, I mean, just before we leave the issue of testimony, one of the people who keeps coming to mind for me when I'm reading your book is Landsman, and Landsman's film, The Shoah, and the attempt there to perform testimony, to elicit the performance of testimony without the document. In a sense, of course, he creates a certain archive of testimony, but an archive that is not of documents, not of documentary footage and films, but of people speaking and recalling. And I think there is this, you know, it's a very extremely complex relationship between here of memory, the relationship between memory and the reproduction of memory, as distinct from the archival drive
for both
documentation and destruction of the fact.
Yeah, this film Shoah for me is a revolutionary moment, really revolutionary in our reflection on testimony, on the event, on history, and so on. Because for the first time, it explores the limit between art and testimony, precisely.
Yes.
And which makes, which is an interrogation not only on art, not only on testimony, of course, but also on art itself. What is it?
Yes.
It had always a relation with testimony. It was excluding testimony from itself, fiction, and so on, so on. But but then, no, we have to understand within art or film or literature also. But because we cannot explore that elsewhere than within art itself, the limit between art and testimony. That that was Lanzmann's work. And in spite of his other doubtful formulations and so on, this is a revolutionary work. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. And also for me, I recall watching Lanzmann's Shoah when I was a student in the late 1980s. Okay. And it was an extremely powerful moment that started to generate some of my own questions. And I think this brings me to the question of art and literature, which is, of course, the subject of the fourth chapter of your book. And indeed, the fact that in other parts of your work, you have been reflecting intensely on Armenian literature.
Of course.
And literature as, if I can put it like this, a form of testimony, although putting into question the testimonial nature of art and literature. So I wanted you to say something about that.
I'm relating this with the question of representation. And also to Lanzmann. At the beginning of our conversation, I thought that we had to distinguish between two things. Which were what? Which were the erasure of the fact on the part of the perpetrator, which is the genocidal will, question of the archive, and so on, and the question of representation. It's a very fourth important distinction and relation between the two. As you know, maybe our dear Jean-Luc Nancy in the 90s wrote an article which has been reprinted in his book, The Ground of the Image, where he expressed himself against, you know, this rhetoric move telling us that we shouldn't have any representation of the Holocaust and so on. It would be sacrilege and things like that. And, you know, the powerful position of Lanzmann, precisely, which was that in his Shoah, he didn't use any archive, he didn't use any fiction, he didn't use any recreation of the... and it was constantly in the present. Jean-Luc Nancy, in this article, tells us that the forbidding of representation, it was edicted in the camps, which means for him that it's part of the genocidal event, the forbidding of representation. And if we forbid representation now in the present, we are simply redoubling the gesture of the perpetrator. And then that's his argument. But then we have to understand better Stewart, and we'll not do that today in our conversation. We have to understand better the strong connection between these two parts, the erasure of the fact and the forbidding of representation. The Armenian writers have, during the whole of the 20th century, they have been confronted to that question, what to do with the events, what to do with this foundational event for the Western Armenians. I'll tell you why there is a difference between Western and Eastern. The ones who were deported, exterminated in the Ottoman Empire, and then constituted the diaspora, and then needed it for decades and decades, first to bear witness, second to retell indefinitely and infinitely about what happened to them 2, 3, 4, 10 decades ago, and so on. And constantly confronted with that, now I'm speaking about Armenian writers. Are we going to represent? Is it possible to represent? Are we going to use? We need infinitely numerous testimonies in order to give an account of the entirety of the event, and so on. And of course, because they were asking themselves this type of question, they were unable to go beyond the documenting aspect of testimony. And at the same time, through their hesitation, through their the impossibility of doing anything with that, anything artistically with testimony, and reciprocally, I would say. And there they were condemned to sterility. It's very strange, huh? And it's only in the last 30 years when in Europe, or in the civilized world, I would say, the meaning of testimony changed, that we understood that a reflection on testimony was possible and necessary, on the essence, on the nature of testimony was not only necessary but possible within the field, and only within the field of art, literature, and so on, that something changed, and that a real reflection began. Of course, Lanzmann is important, but now I will say a few words about Blanchot. If you
allow. Yes, I think the book you were referring, is it The Writing of the Disaster?
The Blanchot. Blanchot book, yes, l'écriture du désastre. That's the
If I may also ask you, and I know we're short of time, as you move to this, I think, very important question of representation and art and Blanchot, is the question of shame, the problem of shame, because the weight carried, the repetition, the reiteration that is demanded by the disaster and destruction is carried in the gesture, the blush in the face. You refer to Agamben, reference in Agamben to the blush. And so this comes from something deep inside. It is it's a somatic manifestation, the blush, and the shame that is carried over generations. So I wondered if you could also comment on that as you move to discuss Blanchot.
Difficult. You understand that it's difficult to speak about shame. It's in the conclusion of my book. It's something that accompanied our lives from the beginning, and I'm saying we're not ashamed of what we were, of what happened. The shame comes when we begin to bear witness, which means then when we bear witness, we are not speaking to ourselves, we are speaking to others. We are asking them to, in French they say, nous les prenons à témoin. We want them to stand as a witness to what? To what happened what happened to us. And then, which also means that we are doing exactly what the perpetrator wanted us to do. Because the perpetrator, when he destroyed the fact within the fact, what he was, the message to the survivor was constantly, no, from the beginning, was prove it if you can, prove it. And of course, we what we have done for now more than a century is, you understand, to stand up and to prove it again and again. That's shameful, Stewart.
Yes.
And I was always constantly transpersed with shame, when I hear the word genocide, because you understand that when the Armenians say, pronounce the word genocide, for them is a performative word. When they are showing themselves as victims, and they want people to understand them as victims. That's shameful, Stewart. Shameful.
I'm
not sure that now today I can say more about shame, but it's founding. It's founding feeling, and it's not finished. I will feel that until the end of my life. And I am combating that. I am the. It's the nerve of what I've written about the difference between genocide and catastrophe. It's really the nerve about this, of what I am saying about the ontological difference between genocide and catastrophe. But let's say a few words about Blanchot, and probably we'll stop there.
Yes.
You know, I've written several times, I would say in French, nous avons besoin d'une phénoménologie du survivant. We need a phenomenology of the survivor. Strange formulation, because philosophically, there is phenomenology where there is an experience. There is an experience where there is a subject. There is a subject where there is history. And it's clear that the survivor is the contrary of all that. He is not the subject. The subject, what is the subject? The subject is the witness of himself. He can witness. He can witness for himself, about himself. He can bear witness, and so on, so on. Then it's this paradoxical formulation that I nonetheless want to keep. We need a phenomenology of the survivor. And of course, it will not be philosophical. It would not be philological, of course. it's very strange. I have never understood why the first one who produced a philology of the survivor, not philosophically, of course, was Maurice Blanchot. He did that in a series of, with his words, récits, novels, stories, short stories, narratives, you know, récit means narrative or account or something like that. And in particular, in that extraordinary 10 pages, the most extraordinary pages ever written by a human hand, I would say, where this page is called, in English, The Madness of the Day.
Yes.
Someone suddenly becomes a survivor. He is accepted in an asylum. He works against himself. Of course, as you know, the survivor works against himself because he wants historians to speak about him. Constantly, that's his essence of the survivor. He is not anything else. How did Blanchot know all this? For me, until now, it's extraordinary. And the interrogators sitting in front of him tell him, after he recounted his history, but they tell him Now you will come to the facts. Mm-hmm. They demand facts. They are historians, philologists, and so on. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the story, there is no story anymore. Plus de récit, plus jamais. Which is a formulation, of course, against the testimony, against the demand of testimony by the archive, by the historians, by themselves, and so on and so on. And one last word. There is this last novel by de Blanchot, which is called The Last Man, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Le Dernier Homme. And who is the last man? He is the one who cannot be the witness of himself. Then yes. Something has been destroyed in him, which is the possibility of witnessing himself. That's a survivor. And if you ask me the question, then how is that possible? The reflecting on writing about the survivor. Someone has done this. It's Maurice Blanchot in a series of novels and stories. And we have to come back to that and to understand what is happening. But also we have to write again. I'm not sure that literature is the good word anymore for that, but about the limit between literature and testimony. In order again and again to experience the essence of both of them, of course, but at the same time to be able to say, like the narrator of Maurice Blanchot, no story anymore, no account anymore, no récit anymore, no testimony anymore. I do not want to be to bear witness. I do not want to narrativize. I do not want to respond to the demand of a narrative, and so on, so on. I am the absolute survivor. I am the absolute survivor.
Mark, thank you so much for this extraordinarily powerful discussion of the many themes that emerge from your book, and for really providing new orientations also in the books and texts that you have pointed me to in the course of this conversation.
Yes.
You have just given me so much more that I will now go back to reading afresh and anew. So I thank you so much for your time.
You have been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.